DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Marianne Glendon, who is the Learn Hand Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and is a former United States Ambassador to the Vatican. Her books include Rights Talk, The Impoverishment of Political Discourse, A Nation Under Lawyers, and A World Made New, Eleanor Roosevelt and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. With Marianne Glendon, we go inside the pages of The Forum and the Tower, how scholars and politicians have imagined the world, from Plato to Eleanor Roosevelt, published by Oxford University Press. In The Forum in the Tower, Marianne Glendon traces high points in the long history of relations between intellectuals and political actors. Through a series of pointed and engaging portraits of major historical figures like Cicero, Burke, de Tocqueville, Machiavelli, Rousseau, Locke, Weber, and Charles Malik, who helped Eleanor Roosevelt draft the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights, Glendon explores the fractious yet fertile meeting ground of political thought and political action. She explores the eternal questions that public-spirited young persons still face. Is politics such a dirty business that I shouldn't get involved? Will I betray my principles by pursuing public office? Can I make a difference, or will my efforts be wasted? Marianne Glendon knows this ground well. She combines her political experience and academic expertise to provide an absorbing account of scholars and statespersons in conflict, compromise, and cooperation. We now begin our discussion with Marianne Glendon. Professor Glendon, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here.
The Forum and the Tower is a fascinating book. It's been a long time since I've read something that has just brought me into the lives of so many different individuals, but yet also was such a compelling read and a challenge for how we act out today. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad that you had that reaction to it, Chris. That's exactly what I was trying to do, is bring some of these people to life and to show the connection between the ideas and the way they played out in the lives of the authors and in our lives.
They are significant characters. That do we hear about them in traditional education today? I mean, is it something that when we think of the lives of Plato, Cicero, even Rousseau, I mean, do we encounter these characters?
One of the reasons I wrote the book was that we encounter their thought, and we don't encounter the person behind the thought. And so, for example, you mentioned Plato. Everyone knows about Plato's Republic, and everybody thinks of Plato as a man who went around with his head in the clouds. Mm. Hardly anyone knows that this is a man who came from a political family, who thought his destiny was to be a politician, who tried four times to be a politician and failed. And his last work, the fruit of his whole lifetime, was a reflection on law and government in the real city, not the ideal republic. I always tell my students, I wish you would read Plato's Laws before you read Plato's Republic.
Mm. It's significant because, as you so beautifully put it in the beginning of the book, that not always easy to live in the body of a scholar and a statesman. Usually it's one or the other.
Yes, it seems to be quite a different set of talents. I could only find two people who really excelled, who achieved greatness in both fields, and those were Cicero and Edmund Burke. I think one of the conclusions that comes out of the book is that, especially in our day where both politics and philosophy are so complex and specialized that the best political achievements come out of collaboration and keeping ideas and practice in tension with one another. Or as one of my professors used to say, the two blades of the scissors are theory and practice, and you can't make a good design without having both of them.
That is the challenge, isn't it? That the idea of the of philosophy, of that the scholar who ponders and thinks of the ideal and then putting it in practice. And there has been disasters chronicled in history from those who bring forth the great ideas, but when they're implemented, cause chaos.
Yes, and I think the people who originated those ideas, if you think about Rousseau or Marx, I think Rousseau would have been appalled if he saw how his ideas were taken out of context and how they morphed into the justifications for the terror of 1793 and the French Revolution. And Marx himself never imagined that his ideas would be put into practice in a country like Russia with the kinds of consequences that flowed from that.
The real gift in this book is, again, it's a practical guide for today. It's important, as we will go back and take a look at some of the lives here, but in today's world, with the transmission of ideas now, So it almost in a flash moment, people can just post things on the internet or published in such a wide variety of ways with news cycles and cable access. It's important that we take a look at the person, isn't it? To see where those thoughts and ideas germinate.
Yes, I think we're drowning in information and ideas, but not in the sense of how to use them and how they might play out in practice and what unintended consequences might follow from what seems like a very good idea.
Mm. When you talked about Cicero, I think that was one of the most delightful chapters in the book. I mean, they're all just gems, but his life in particular, what an outstanding man. I mean, we think of, as you said, Julius Caesar is the one that stands out, but Cicero really has the lasting effect.
Yes, and how amazing that he had effects that he couldn't have anticipated. For example, hundreds of years after his death, a 19-year-old pagan boy in North Africa, St. Augustine, mm-hmm. picks up one of Cicero's books and writes, "This Cicero brought me to you, O Lord, turned my thoughts to you by turning me to philosophy." How amazing that Cicero participated in the conversion of Augustine.
Well, isn't there something about that expression of the good, that God is present in something that is authentic and true?
How true, yes. Mm.
That ability to be able to maintain your integrity, that compatibility in the person, of trying to be, again, that scholar and statesman, that's the challenge. And can we meet it today? Is it possible for someone in today's world to be able to be a Cicero?
One of the reasons I wrote this book, Chris, was the experience of having known many students who come to law school with the idea they want to go into public service, and then 3 years later, when they're ready to graduate, they turn away. And they give you reasons like, oh, politics is too corrupt. I might lose my soul in the process. I might have to compromise so much to get into a position where I could do some good that I would turn myself into a different kind of person. And so I wanted to show my students how truly great figures in the past had struggled with the very same questions that our students struggle with today. And another thought that I have as I think about this problem of moral compromise is that even those of us who don't go into politics, nobody gets through this journey through life without being faced with serious moral decisions. They aren't always in the newspapers or held up to public view. But I think that's what stories like Pilgrim's Progress are trying to tell us, that everybody is faced with serious moral questions as we go through life.
Oh, that term you use, compromise. that's the challenge in many ways. And I just think of it, our late great Holy Father John Paul, and of course you knew him. And when you look at the example of trying to have that balance, the philosopher, he ultimately was the statesman, wasn't he?
He certainly was. You know, many people ask me if I were to include recent characters or living characters in my book, who would I have included? And I always think first of John Paul II as someone who was a world-class philosopher and also a great statesman who changed the world in so many ways with that visit to Poland. And I also think of a man who died yesterday, Václav Havel, who was a great literary figure and also a wonderful force in bringing down totalitarian regimes in Eastern Europe.
It is dangerous for that scholar sometimes to speak out, because no matter what they're encountering, it could put their lives quite literally in jeopardy, can it?
Yes, and Cicero lost his life for speaking out against Mark Antony. And Edmund Burke lost his political position for putting his career on the line. He did it three times, and the third time, finally, his party split with him and never proposed him for public office again.
Fun chapters in the book was the scholar and the statesman, Thomas Hobbes and Edward Coke.
Oh, I'm glad you liked that one.
It was. I mean, I had never appreciated, really, the link between the two, especially in the way that you presented it.
Oh, well, there's an example of a scholar, Thomas Hobbes, really a wonderful, entertaining writer, but someone who had very little contact with politics. And those people are quite dangerous because they, think of Hobbes, think of Rousseau, think of Marx. They are powerful, persuasive writers. They really have the gift, but they don't have the sense of how ideas play out in action.
Mm. Edward Coke, of course, in the chapter, you appreciate the turn he made. I mean, is there conversion going on there? I mean, in the way that as a jurist, very, very strict, but then as a judge over the courts, tempered.
Yes, I think you could think of it as a conversion. I think lawyers would tend to say, well, the role of an advocate is different from the role of a judge, and you step into the role and you try to fulfill the expectations of that role. But I think you're right. In the case of Coke, who tortured people mm-hmm. with some glee when he was serving the crown, he turned into a great challenger of royal power, and I think there was a real change of heart and mind.
Mm. Of course, Machiavelli, I think, is somebody such an enigma, and I think you really try to help us get a definition on his philosophy and his life and try to put it in perspective. Today, again, we go back to today's politician, that there seems to be lots of little Machiavellis.
Yes, I think there are, and maybe not as noble as Machiavelli was in some sense. That is, Machiavelli really knew and loved and appreciated the classics, even though he fought against them. And he still has his defenders, especially the Italian biographers, who see him as chiefly a figure who was depending free government in the Italian Republican city-states.
Mm. In studying him, I mean, it's good to have him in the same book as a Tocqueville, because he comes and he is watching how a government, how powers rise, how people can be ruled. And yet, even the world that he saw all those years ago in the United States, it's changed. It has changed quite a great deal, hasn't it?
Yes, but what hasn't changed is that there are still people like Machiavelli who think about politics as chiefly about the getting and keeping of power. And then there are people like Cicero and Edmund Burke who thought about politics in the way Aristotle taught us to think about it, as free persons deliberating about how to order their lives together. And that's the fault line that runs through political thought. And of course it is both. Pope Benedict went to Germany just recently and spoke to the Bundestag in Germany, and he said, of course politicians have to think about succeeding. Of course they have to think about getting into office. But he reminded them that politics can be a sacred vocation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bring that out in the book so beautifully, too. What I love about your writing on this is that you really are lifting up the dignity of that person, and the challenge that they've had in their life. I mean, just whether it's Plato starting out not necessarily seeking the way his life would lead, or any of the persons that you bring forward, it's you've treated each person as the unique individual they were, not just the founder of an ideal.
I thought it would be interesting especially for young people to see how difficult it is to discern one's vocation. And of course, we as Christians start out with the notion that our basic vocation is the one we receive in baptism to holiness, but we also receive in baptism a vocation to mission or evangelization, the mission to transform the world. And that brings us into politics. And you mentioned John Paul II. He points out in that wonderful letter to the laity, mm-hmm. that I'm sure many of your listeners have read and thought about, that every one of us lay people, even contemplatives, even cloistered contemplatives, are praying for the world. They're not just lost in mystical contemplation. They're praying for the world. And we lay people, we have a vocation to transform the world, which leads some of us into politics and seeking public office, but most of us into politics part-time, in the sense of trying to be informed voters and to take whatever role we can in public life. John Paul II has a wonderful passage in Christi Fidelis Laici, where he says, there's no excuse for staying away from politics simply because you feel that it might be a moral danger. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. He knew so much mm-hmm. about the moral danger himself, and yet he said, you've got to do it.
And you never know. You just never know where God is leading you, because when you read the chapter on the First Lady and the philosopher, who would have thought that a Lebanese philosopher and a woman born from, you know, the turn of the century America would end up crafting one of the most remarkable pieces of world legislation ever.
Yes, and that's a wonderful example of a philosopher, Charles Malik, and a very sophisticated political figure, Eleanor Roosevelt, collaborating, each one bringing to the table something that the other lacked. And how funny that Eleanor Roosevelt, who was something of an anti-Catholic herself, she collaborated with the man who brought so much of Catholic social thought into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It is remarkable, isn't it? What is the challenge for us today, then? I mean, what would you say to the young person that is sitting out there trying to discern that vocation, or even those of us who are, we can't really call ourselves young anymore, but who are trying to navigate in these waters?
Young people always say, I read college applications and law school applications where more than any other statement that you see in these applications, you see, I want to make a difference. They come to our educational institutions with the desire to make a difference. And I think what we all have to keep in mind is we will make a difference. That's really not the question. The question is, what kind of difference will we make? We are going to make a difference either promoting the culture of life or facilitating the opposite. So I think the first thing that one has to keep in mind is to prayerfully discern where God is leading us.
Mm. And that discernment needs to take place in everyday moment, doesn't it? I mean, that's the world we're living in today. I mean, almost every day there's a challenge for us.
It really is true, Chris. I think when people say, I'm worried about politics because it's so corrupt and so filled with temptations and the distinction between political and moral compromise is so hard to discern, politics isn't all that different from everybody's journey through life. Everybody is facing temptations. That's the human condition.
Mm. We're talking with Mary Ann Glendon, the author of The Forum and the Tower, How Scholars and Politicians Have Imagined the World from Plato to Eleanor Roosevelt. And Mary Ann, your role as ambassador to the Vatican several years ago, that must have been just an extraordinary experience to be a part of that statescraft.
It was an extraordinary experience, especially since it was a year when relationships between the United States and the Holy See were as good as they have ever been. George Bush and Pope Benedict had 3 visits in an 18-month period, and they were extraordinarily close and happy occasions.
Our Holy Father it's been reported that he's frail, and that there's concern now about his health. Do you mind sharing what you may know or what your thoughts are on that?
Well, I read an article in the Associated Press today that it seemed to me to exaggerate the extent of the Pope's frailty. I must say that I'm impressed that a man of his age, I think he's 85, that he has recently taken all these trips where he gives several speeches a day. He keeps up a schedule that would exhaust a much younger person. So I think it's not surprising that he is making certain accommodations to the frailty of his age. He started using a platform. He leans on the elbows of his assistants, but the energy level is greater than that of any 85-year-old that I know.
I think I'd be doing a lot of leaning if I moved as much as he does. Well, in the Forum in the Tower, you did mention that people have asked you, who would you include? Would Benedict be near that, in that area? I mean, given the prestige and the just the great light of the Holy Father he has followed?
It's interesting that you speak of Benedict in that context, because there's a man who I think, until he became Pope, never thought of himself and as the kind of public figure he was forced to become at a very advanced age. And yet he has filled that role amazingly in these trips that many people predicted would be difficult. He came away just having more than fulfilled the highest expectations people had, his trip to England, his trip to Germany. So he definitely is in the category of great philosopher already, and he certainly seems to be filling the role of statesman.
Yeah, I remember when he was brought forward as our pontiff that it was said that he probably wouldn't travel as much as John Paul. And yet it sure seems as though he's getting out and about. I mean, he really is he's everywhere.
He's traveling a lot, and he's giving these wonderful short speeches. I wish somebody would collect just the speeches that he has given in political settings, the speeches that he gave to the United Nations, to the British at Westminster, to the German Bundestag. These are gems and really full of practical guidance on the relationship between politics and morality.
Well, this is a time of tremendous change, isn't it? I mean, from your vantage point, looking at what's happening in the world today, from the changes in the, well, in the former Soviet Union, to what's occurring even in North Korea today, as well as just everything in the Middle East, the world is shifting dramatically. We need those scholar statesmen. We really need that today, don't we?
I think we need it more than ever.
Well, I just wish we had more time. And I just, Marianne, any final thoughts?
I think the moral of the story really is that we do make a difference with our thoughts and our actions. We are always constituting ourselves as people and collectively as a society, and we need to keep theory and practice in close relationship to each other.
Would you have a note there for the parent of the young person who wants to go into law, as far as an encouragement? I mean, you see those fresh faces every day.
Well, I'm a parent of a daughter who went into law, and I think these young people, they give me incredible hope, because they do come full of enthusiasm, full of idealism, and I think they need to be encouraged, as John Paul II encouraged them. Don't shy away from taking a role in public life simply because it is full of moral pitfalls. Life is full of moral pitfalls, and if you have the gifts and talents to make a difference in public life, you should go for it.
And I just also want to thank you on behalf of so many women who are participating in endow programs throughout this area and, of course, around the nation, maybe even around the world. Just the contributions that you've been able to give to that particular outreach and lifting up the hearts and the minds of so many of us.
Well, I'm a great admirer of Endow and follower of its efforts from the beginning, and I'm so grateful to the women who have been keeping it going and expanding it.
Professor Marianne Glynn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
With Marianne Glendon, we've gone inside the pages of The Forum and the Tower, how scholars and politicians have imagined the world from Plato to Eleanor Roosevelt. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to oup.com, the website for its publisher, Oxford University Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from today's most compelling authors.